Before we start, I just want to check. For those who got a little information about the call in advance, are there any questions you have up front that you want to make sure that we cover today? What attracted you to the call in terms of those, you know, a couple of questions that you want to make sure that we cover when we're talking? Anyone? Okay, we will get started on the call. We're going to start with Donna Klein, who will start with an overview of voluntary employer practices related to flex time options. Donna, what companies do you know of? What companies are currently engaged in voluntary practices related to flex time? And what's some of the overarching information that you have? I know that you've recently done a report that talks about the benefits of flex time and flexible workplaces.
Right, and that's probably a logical place to start. Tricia, I forwarded you a PowerPoint. Do the people on the call have that PowerPoint?
Yes, they do. Okay, Everyone who registered and RSVP'd was sent a PowerPoint.
Right. So we'll just kind of use that as a frame if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly flexibility is on the rise, if you will. Corporate Voices did release last November a major study on the business utilization of flexibility and the return on the business investment, if you will. Let me just give you a little bit of background on Corporate Voices. We do have 52 best practice companies as part of our coalition. In fact, Goldman and PNC, Deloitte and Caliber, who mentioned, I think, are participating in this call, are some of our members. We're 5 years old this year, and the space we're operating in is a very unique space. We're actually operating between sectors. And to move the corporations to a place where they are willing to dialogue with policymakers on domestic policy issues, social policy, is really new behavior for the corporations. And so we think that the strength of the coalition is the caliber of our companies and also the size of our companies. We have approximately 4 million working families represented in all 50 states, and they collectively drive over $1 trillion worth of revenue annually. 70% of them are Fortune 100 best companies. And you can see who they are on the PowerPoint. I won't waste time going through who they are. The study that we did last year was focused on flexibility in its broadest context. We were trying to study the flexibility in the sense of when work gets done, how it gets done, and many times where it gets done. So we looked at flexibility in a very broad sense as really the 21st century response to a one-size-fits-all way of working, which is the former model. The corporations within Corporate Voices coalitions made an assumption, really, and that is that flexibility is a business strategy. It's not an accommodation, which it's always positioned as in many corporations. And it's also not a solution to women's issues or family issues particularly. We really, with the study, wanted to measure a couple objectives. We wanted to define the business benefit of flexibility. We, of course, intuitively felt there was a benefit to the business, not only to the individual employee. And we then wanted to expand flexibility as a core business practice. The findings from our comparative research is that there is a compelling business case to expand flexibility. In fact, the business case, we think, is very robust. We looked at data from 28 individual companies, and the positive impact is substantial. We were really quite surprised. It's more than generally we thought existed. And the companies are using very sophisticated measurement techniques to track really what flexibility is doing. So these companies, these 28 companies, have independently developed a positive business case. And this is data that has been published in this report that's previously proprietary company data, in other words, not part of the public domain, had not been previously published in most cases. The cumulative findings indicate from these 28 companies that there's three kinds of business impact, and this is across companies and across industries. We found positive human capital outcomes, positive talent management outcomes, and actually positive financial performance and operational outcomes. Now, human capital outcomes, we're talking about engagement, stress reduction, and really the contributions of discretionary effort. Talent management really focuses on recruitment and retention impact. And we actually found revenue increases for sales staff who were on flexibility from AstraZeneca and GlaxoSmithKline. We also found some reductions in cycle time, PNC reported. And those have direct impact on financial performance and operations. Just to give you an idea of how the power of human capital outcomes, they are very robust, and we go to great extents to talk about this so that people don't assume they are just self-report, I feel better. We do measure employee satisfaction, but employee satisfaction is a validated research construct that has relates to performance, incremental performance differences. In terms of employee engagement and commitment and really what that means, Corporate Leadership Council has documented a formula that is pretty widely acceptable in terms of measuring differences, and they have documented that every 10% improvement in commitment increases discretionary effort by 6% and performance by 2%. And we oftentimes look at that as a service profit chain or call that a service profit chain. Hewitt Associates, of course, has documented, and this has been well publicized, that double-digit growth companies have 39% more highly engaged employees and 45% fewer disengaged employees. And of course, that again is another way of looking at the impact of discretionary effort. Stress indicators are very well documented. That's been very well publicized. Stress is reported to be responsible for 19% of absenteeism, 40% of turnover, 55% of EAP costs. And, of course, you can read the rest of those. But stress is something that is really creating a tremendous burden to businesses overall and has been reported to be doing that for actually over a decade or so. Some of the examples from our own study for these human capital outcomes, if we want to look at increased satisfaction, IBM has documented repeatedly that higher flexibility scores does relate to job satisfaction. The rating of the company as a great place to work, as a healthy place to work, and an increase in employee sense of accomplishment. J.P. Morgan Chase, also a participant in the study, documented that access to flexibility affects overall satisfaction, again, and perception of the company. The importance of this finding is that it's both formal and informal. One thing that the study points out is that access to flexibility as little as one time per month has dramatic effect on the employee loyalty and commitment to the company.
Donna, this is Tricia.
Yes.
You talked about IBM and JP Morgan and their flexibility scores and the impact. Could you just give like a couple of brief examples based on your knowledge of the types of flexibility that they're implementing that are what caused them to have these great scores?
Well, both IBM and JP Morgan implement a wide variety of flexibility. In most of these studies, in most of these companies, what we're talking about is a culture of flexibility. And that's where we get into the informal and occasional flexibility also. We're talking about the ability of an individual employee to negotiate an arrangement with the company or the individual manager, first line supervisor, if you will, that not only benefits the employee but also benefits the company. So we're not talking about a rigid set of what we used to call in the business alternate work arrangements. We used to refer to things as job sharing and telecommuting and compressed work week and reduced work week. That is not to say worker flexibility now excludes those arrangements. But what happened is those arrangements were implemented well over a decade or so ago, and they themselves became rigid. So what we're looking about is we're looking at now is really a culture of flexibility, one that's open enough and trusting enough for an employee to be able to request flexibility and whatever variety it may be, and have it be considered as something that is not negatively necessarily going to negatively impact the job performance.
Very interesting. Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. AstraZeneca, of course, you can see there on the chart, treatment scores for people who had flexibility were anywhere between 28 to 32% higher. That's a Deloitte finding from Deloitte as well. And that, of course, commitment, remember, is really measures the likelihood of an employee contributing discretionary effort. You know, by discretionary effort, we're talking about going above and beyond the call of duty, if you will. IBM, again, people with flexibility were able to work more hours before feeling stressed. That's somewhat of a controversial finding because some people look at flexibility as being an answer to overwork. And the fact is we are not promoting flexibility so that people can overwork. That's obviously a personal choice. But we want to look at flexibility as a way to get a job done, not a way to get, not a way to increase the number of hours working per se. Bristol Myers Squibb on the next slide. I think this is a really powerful slide. Of employees hired in the last 3 years, the percent who are influenced by BMS's availability of flexible arrangements. Overall, 21% were influenced in their decision to go with Bristol Myers Squibb. Women, 30%, men, 12%. I think we should be cautious about the 12%, though, because I think that it is only 12% now. Well, the data says that men want flexibility as much as women, but men are still perceiving it as a career hit, if you will, if they utilize it, a potential career hit. And I think as we encourage men and position flexibility as a management tool rather than accommodation, the utilization by men and the willingness to admit they want flexibility is going to increase dramatically. I think the numbers are different now because men are still looking at it as a solution for women or an accommodation. In terms of employee retention, this is a talent management set of outcomes. Accenture, of course, flexibility is the top three choice among people who stayed with Accenture and would have considered leaving a job previously. The same for IBM. You'll see flexibility as the number one issue for mothers. AstraZeneca, 96% said they stay with AstraZeneca because of flexibility. Deloitte has actually documented that a number's a little old, but it's quite an aggressive way to go about documenting things. But in 2003, documented $41.5 million in savings and turnover-related costs alone. Talent recruitment, you can see some tracking that Discovery has done in terms of people taking a job, 95% reported that the availability of flexible work arrangements was a critical factor. Financial performance, of course, and this is what is sometimes of critical importance to finance types, but GlaxoSmithKline has reported increased productivity for job shares in the customer service functions of their company. AstraZeneca has documented increased revenue or increased yield. These are for their pharma sales reps. The ones who are on flexible schedules have actually produced more than the ones who were not. I mentioned before, PNC has been able to document process improvements, business process improvements. This particular process improvement was relating to a bond department, I think. It had to do with cycle time. Client service improvement, Deloitte has measured greater client satisfaction for those employees who are on a flexible work schedule versus those that are not on a flexible work schedule. This is data collected from an actual client base. Just in summary, this is really robust data. 28 companies have independently produced very, very positive business impacts from flexibility. And the flexibility is both on business outcomes, but also people effects and therefore family effects. So we have taken this report and positioned flexibility because of the analytical rigor, I think, and the nature of the data. I think we feel very, very comfortable in saying that expanding flexibility is certainly not an accommodation, but it is a business imperative. In other words, not promoting flexibility is not making the most of the management tools available to employers now to stay competitive and get the best results from people.
Donna, before we move into the policy side of what we're doing, I'm just curious. This is Tricia. What do you think is the likelihood, or what, just, and I know this is ballparking it, but what do you think in terms of the thousands, millions of employers in the United States, how many of them do you think really understand the message of creating this corporate culture of flexibility versus just having some rigid policies? Mm-hmm. What do you think the state of the employment field is in terms of these corporate culture sort of organizations?
Well, I think it probably tracks very consistently with any other new behavioral learning. I think they're going to start out with something they're comfortable with, and many employers have started out. I think the data shows very clearly that flexibility is increasing. Sometimes it's not because employers understand the business case, but sometimes it's because of they really have no choice. If you look at the hotel industry, of course, which is my background, I mean, you talk to a hotel manager and they spend a good portion of their work week figuring out what the schedule is for employees, that hourly employees, because if they don't accommodate their personal needs, then they don't have adequate staff to carry on the functions of the hotel. So, in other words, it's organic. On one level, they begin with accommodating employees, but then we're hoping that those who are resisting even the accommodation of employees can now look at flexibility as a management strategy rather than just something they need to do because of staffing issues.
Very interesting. I am going to, I do hope, Donna, that you can, I know you're leaving at 3, I hope you can stay on for the remainder of the call to hear.
Yes, I just do want to mention, too, though, that for anyone who hears this recording, this report is free and downloadable from our website, corporatevoices.org.
Excellent. Thank you. And we will also have a link. We also have a link to that from BPW's Online Resource Center, and we'll make sure that it's associated with the call as well.
Great.
It's an excellent report. We are going to move into sort of the policy section, and then people who also want to ask questions of Donna and Katie and Sharon will have an opportunity towards the end of the call to do that. So we'll be sure everyone gets a chance to ask questions. Why are you looking at, we've heard about the voluntary practices, and we've heard the things that are compelling and drawing employers into doing things voluntarily. Why are you looking at policy proposals in addition to business practice? Why is policy an important part of the conversation around flexibility?
Well, thanks again, Tricia, for inviting us to join this call. And as you mentioned, I'm the co-director of this policy initiative here at Georgetown called Workplace Flexibility 2010. And to start answering your question, I'll give you a bit of background on who we are, because I think that will really sort of help folks on the phone understand what it is we bring to this particular conversation and specifically this phone call.
Excellent.
So our project is one component of a broader national initiative on workplace flexibility that is sponsored by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. And over the past 10 years, primarily what the Sloan Foundation has done in this area is funded lots and lots of academic research in the area of work-family. And what their research showed is that, guess what, there's a profound mismatch between the needs and priorities of families and the way that work is currently structured, full-time, full-year arrangements, often with few or no opportunities for time off. And, you know, that's something that I think, you know, for me at least when I walked into this issue a few years ago was not so surprising because all of us can look at our own lives and come up with ways where sometimes work just doesn't fit with our family life. But in terms of policy, I also wanted to set the stage that this isn't just about one family or a few families, that there are really some big demographic changes in our country over the past years that are really pushing and driving this issue around flexibility. So, for example, an obvious one, most families now have both parents working. In 1970, two-thirds of married couples had one spouse at home. By 2000, 60% of married couples had both spouses working. So you have two folks working but still this job at home to do. People are increasingly working into old age. By 2008, one out of every six workers will be over 55, and by 2015, they'll be 20% of the total workforce. And older workers expect to keep working, either because they want to or need to, but they also want flexibility. They don't want their jobs to be so highly structured. And also there's the issue around, more and more of us are likely to be providing care for aging parents as folks live longer. And then there's a generational difference that I'm sure all of you in your different work settings have seen, which is that Gen X and Gen Y generations, they don't want to work the same way that their parents did. They want more control over their time and how they do their job. So not surprisingly, all in all, when you take a step back, nearly 80% of employees want more flexibility. That's across gender, across race, across income. So there's a real demand driving the conversation. And when Sloan took a step back and looked at all of this data, they thought about, okay, how do you respond to this this issue? And one of the key principles that's driving the overall initiative is that workplace flexibility requires both the voluntary employer practice, which Donna talked about, as well as public policy reform. And again, in regard to the first track, you just heard from Donna Klein at Corporate Voices, who's done amazing work in this area, and worked with the Sloan Foundation. And then the second track of the initiative focuses on public policy, and obviously that's where we come in. So we are a policy initiative located at Georgetown Law, and our mission is to expand the public policy conversation on workplace flexibility in Washington, D.C., and to bring together diverse constituencies to develop what we call consensus-based policy solutions that would work for both employers and families. And just to answer your question a little more directly, why public policy? Well, I think that, to some degree, the last thing on your mind is any one of us is trying to juggle caregiving responsibilities, get to the grocery store, achieve our goals at work. The last thing is, how can public policy or government help me? But we really believe that public policy can help in at least two ways. First, it shapes how many different options are available, so it can make it easier or harder for employers to offer flexibility options. For example, there may be barriers to flexibility in current law. One of the examples that I use is phased retirement. Lots of older workers want to phase out of retirement rather than dropping off the cliff, and under current tax code and ERISA rules, that makes it difficult for them to draw down their pensions as a phased retiree at the same time that they're working. So we're taking a look at that issue. And second, public policy can kind of change the cost of choosing one option over another. And there I think about part-time and how part-time work often comes with high costs in terms of health benefits, retirement options, promotion opportunities in some companies. But the costs also don't necessarily have to be that high. So public policy really shapes the context that whether it's employers are working in and that employees are living in. But the key thing for us is that in order to do effective public policy on these issues, we really believe it's necessary to first build a partnership between employers, employees, and policymakers to come up with these consensus-based policy solutions that will work for both business and families. And one thing to keep in mind as we start this conversation and as Sharon Masling gets more into the different models we've been looking at is that Workplace Flexibility 2010, our project, we don't have the answers yet on what the best policy approach is or should be. In fact, we very much look at this as our name suggests, that by 2010 we would like to develop with a group of in partnership with business and family groups and policymakers these consensus-based policy options, which is why we built that deadline in our head to give us a little, some incentive to get the job done. But so all of our activities really kind of go to this, that we're really building a substantive knowledge base on current law and policies. We're looking at different models of policy, both here and abroad. We're using research data, that rich Sloan research database, to ensure that the policy discussion is rooted in the facts as best we know them. And we're looking at a range of policy options. So at this point, like I said, we don't have an opinion on what's good or bad or otherwise, but rather identifying the pros and cons of each approach and thinking through, how does this work for business and how would this work for families. So when I first met with Patricia a few months ago, one thing that immediately struck me is that BPW itself is involved in a similar type of exercise, which is through your national employer group, you're really trying to connect kind of the needs of women and the needs of business and start that same type of dialogue. So that's why I'm particularly glad to join you today.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And it was one of the things that excited us deeply about being able to work with you as well, because that was something that came up, is we want to create a sense of common ground and help. We are essentially a neutral convener. And so things like this call and the summit and other opportunities to bring working women and men together with employers so that they can together create a sense of common ground of things they need to create successful workplaces, fix it, is what we're trying to do. And that we have a group, two groups who are working on both already capturing voluntary practice and the state of policy is quite exciting, that we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We can all work together to walk together to a common goal. And to that end, Sharon, if you could share with us an idea of the landscape of policy in this area. What's the current state of law related to flex work options? And what should employers know? And what should employees possibly know about these?
Okay, well, first of all, I just want to say hello and thank you so much for inviting us onto this call. When you think about federal legislation regarding workplace flexibility right now, there's not that much. There's the Family and Medical Leave Act, which, as most of you probably know, requires 12 weeks of unpaid leave to take care of a new child, a seriously ill family member, or to address one's own serious health condition. If you work for a state or local government office, the Fair Labor Standards Act allows your employer to give you compensatory time off in lieu of overtime pay. And if you work for the federal government, federal law encourages, but does not require, your employer to provide you with flex time, compressed work weeks, or telecommuting options. But when we surveyed the landscape, we discovered that's about it on the federal level. So when we start to think about public policy options for increasing access to workplace flexibility, we first spent a lot of time trying to conceptualize what we were even talking about. We knew that true workplace flexibility, as Donna had mentioned, was much more than just flex time or telecommuting. So after many months of discussion, we finally came up with a multi-pronged definition, which, Trish, I believe everyone on this call has a copy of?
Yes. Everyone who RSVP'd was sent the PDF.
Great.
Yours. If for some reason you don't have it, please feel free to email me at foundation@bpwusa.org. That's foundation@bpwusa.org, and I'll send it to you right away.
So for those who do have the PDF, you can see that we define workplace flexibility as the ability to have flexibility in the scheduling of full-time hours. It's flexibility in the ability to have flexibility in the number of hours worked. It's the ability to have career flexibility, to actually exit the workforce and to re-enter it. And then it's also the ability to address unexpected and ongoing personal and family needs. When we sat down to try to figure out, okay, so this is our overarching definition, but when we're looking at public policy, what are we trying to address? We realized that really we're talking about six different issues, all related, but still distinct issues that may need to be addressed differently. The first issue is short-term time off. And we define short-term time off as time off that's less than 5 days. It may be because a worker needs time off because he or she is sick, because his or her child is sick. There may be a school conference. There may be a death in the family. There's an emergency home repair to be addressed. Many, many reasons why workers need what we call short-term time off. Then there are the flexible work arrangements. Those, as Donna said, sometimes are called alternative work arrangements, flexible arrangements. We're talking about the workers, people who work full-time, generally 40 hours a week, sometimes more, and full year, but they want to work a non-traditional schedule or in a different location. They may want to work a compressed work week. They may want to start at 7 a.m. and leave at 3 p.m. They may only want to work for part of the year. They may want to telecommute. Then there's the need of some workers who need what we have called episodic time off, where there is some type of need that causes the worker to need time off on a sporadic or a periodic basis. So, for example, it may be a worker with a chronic health condition, such as migraine headaches. It may be because a child has a sporadic health condition, such as asthma, where a parent will have to rush the child to the hospital. It may be because the person needs time off because they're attending a class on Wednesday afternoons. But the time off happens on a relatively regular basis, sometimes scheduled, sometimes not. We've also talked about reduced hours, which some people lap into flexible work arrangements. We pulled it out because it's generally people who want to work either less than 40 hours a week or less than full year. Someone may need to take care of a young child. They may have a chronic health condition. They may, as Katie mentioned before, want to phase into retirement. Then there's the need for what we call extended time off, the worker who needs to take an extended period of time to take care of a newborn or a new child, to address a serious health condition. Sometimes someone may be in the hospital themselves and then needs time to recovery, so it's more than just a week or two. And finally, there's what we call career exit and reentry ramps, which, as I mentioned, it's a worker who needs to or chooses to take time off from the workforce completely, but who hopes to reenter the workforce at a later point in time. When talking about these, we also were trying to figure out, well, what can public policy do to address these different needs? And we agreed that for each of these areas, public policy can play at least four different roles. It can remove legal obstacles to flexibility, as Katie mentioned, the tax code for an example. It can provide employees with an enforceable right to ask for flexibility, and I'll get into that in a little bit. It can incentivize employers to provide flexibility. What will make employers want to provide flexibility? And finally, as governments can do, it can mandate, it can require that employers provide some type of flexibility. So I'll just give you one example to start. We started with short-term time off and discovered that right now there's no legislation on this issue. Interestingly, using the research and data that Katie mentioned, we learned that almost 49% of American workers have no access to designated paid sick leave coverage. And even fewer than that have time off or protected time off when their child is sick. There actually is an interesting study that just came out of Hastings Law School chronicling some of those issues. So recently on the Hill, we've seen some proposals. We've seen a proposal to require employers to provide paid sick leave to their employees. There have been a number of proposals to expand the FMLA to provide time off for school-related conferences and other family-related issues. And there have also been proposals to allow private sector employers to provide comp time in lieu of overtime pay. None of these proposals have gone very far, but they're just an example of the different roles that public policy can play.
Sharon, in terms of the experience that you've had and what you've looked at, even though there's not a great deal to look at the federal landscape, of those bills that seem to be introduced or looked at, what are the ones that seem to have the most play or seem to have the biggest health issue, to be the healthiest options in terms of people continue to talk about them and move them forward? Are they the ones that are more about providing incentives or the ones about providing requirements? What seems to be the ones that are currently existing? Are they more requirements, incentives, or a combination of all of the four that you mentioned?
You know, I think it's a combination. I think there are different constituencies who are advocating for different bills that help their constituencies the most. I think there are different members of Congress who are interested in different kinds of approaches, and that's why, as Kate had mentioned before, we're working on building a bipartisan consensus. We're working on building a coalition of both employers and employees so that all issues are represented, and then they can hash out what they think is the best approach. right now all of them are being talked about.
And what about those areas that we more commonly think about when we talk flexibility that you had mentioned earlier as well? Are there any proposals on the Hill or that you're aware of related to those?
You know, this is where there's definitely some legislation on the Hill. There's some legislation that has actually been passed and a lot of stuff going on abroad as well. So, for example, the Federal Employees Federal and Compressed Work Schedules Act, it's a mouthful, I know, it authorizes federal employers to provide flexible and compressed work week schedules to their employees. Interesting, the law does not require that the employers provide such schedules. Rather, it provides a framework in which these schedules can be provided, and it removes some of the legal obstacles under relevant wage and hour laws. In addition, some federal appropriations bills have required federal agencies to establish policies that allow eligible federal employees to telecommute. There have been a lot of interesting work in the United Kingdom right now. They recently passed a law regarding what we call a right to ask law. The law mandates that employers have a process in which an employee with a child under the age of 6 or under the age of 18 if the child has a disability, where the employee can actually ask for a flexible work arrangement. So it's not a guarantee to have the arrangement, it's a guarantee to have a process where they can ask. And the employer can deny the request for a whole host of business reasons that are enumerated in the statute. There's been some discussion about introducing a bill on the Hill that's patterned after the UK law. It hasn't been introduced yet, but there has been discussion about that. In Australia, they have a law that requires employees to grant all reasonable requests by what they call caregivers, and that they have to provide flexible work arrangements absent what they call unjustifiable hardship. And finally, there are some laws in the United States that, while they're not traditionally seen as workplace flexibility laws, still impact flexibility. For example, the ADA requires that employers provide persons with disabilities reasonable accommodations, including flexible or reduced schedules. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act requires the same for persons with religious needs. And the Family and Medical Leave Act, in addition to extended time off, also requires reduced hour schedules for those with serious health conditions or those providing care to family members with serious health conditions who need that reduced hour schedule.
And this is Katie. I just wanted to jump in at the end. So as you can see from what Sharon, you know, in very quick summary described, we're really just kind of setting the table, you know, in putting out all of these different options and models that are out there, some incentives, some mandates, you know, something somewhere in between. And then what we're doing through, at this point, a working group process is just starting to plumb the depths of what are the pros and cons from both the business perspective and the employee perspective of these approaches. And that will really give us some of the data as we start to move forward and really bring together different constituency groups to a table and start to talk about possible policy solutions.
I think what's interesting, this is Tricia, is that in more and more things that I'm attending that are a combination of employers as well as groups that support constituencies that work with employers or work with employees, is that conversation around common ground of consensus building really seems to be building, that there seems to be more of an impetus around that, that if we're going to accomplish anything that's going to be lasting and substantive, we need to accomplish those together. So I think that's interesting that seems to be coming to the forefront. To Sharon or Katie or to Donna, what are some of the other issues you'll be taking a look at in the next few months? To Sharon and Katie, in terms of policy, what are some of the issues you'll be looking at?
I think on our plate is kind of the list that you have in front of you. We've gone into short-term time off. We've studied flexible work arrangements in detail. And now we're turning to episodic time off, reduced hours, extended time off, and career exit and reentry. And interestingly, there's some policy on each of these areas, although the least is career exit and reentry. And actually, depending on how much time we have on the call, we'd love to hear back from the participants about what role, if any, do you think public policy could play in that arena?
You know, Deloitte, this is Donna. Deloitte's doing some major work on customizing careers, what they refer to it as, that is off-ramping and then on-ramping again. It's very, very interesting, the model they put together. We are working, by the way, because I almost had to get off the phone. We are beginning another original research project, Tricia, that is going to be 9 months in length to document the business case. Number one, determine if there is a business case, and if so, document the business case for flexibility among hourly workers. Hourly. The flexibility discussion of the last decade has been pretty much focused on managers and professionals, whereas the large and ever-growing service industry in this country, flexibility is a major work requirement for those workers as well.
I think also as we look at the desire by many maturing workers, that whole phased retirement aspect, those options
yes.
that are more flexible and hourly.
Hourly for pay structures, yes, definitely.
Well, at this point, I think we've had some fascinating conversations with our speakers. I'd love to open it up to the people on the call who've dialed in to have any questions that you might have for, let's start with Donna, because I think she has to get off pretty quickly. Any questions for Donna, and then we'll go to Katie and Sharon.
Sounds like no, but I have a question for Sharon.
Uh-huh.
I should know the answer to this myself, but I don't. You were mentioning that the federal government has made an option available for federal employers to give flexibility to workers, and that flexibility, and you mentioned certain flavors of flexibility, if you will, and they are therefore by doing so, they are exempt from FLSA laws?
They're not exempt per se. If they choose to take what's called the compressed work week option, there may be FLSA implications, and there's also Title V that affects federal workers, where they're under the FLSA, they have to provide overtime pay if they work more than 40 hours
right.
in a work week. Under Title V, it's if they work more than 8 hours in a work day.
Right.
And so for individuals who specifically are in a compressed work week schedule with their employers,
mm-hmm.
those provisions do not apply, but it's not generally across the board.
Well, why can, since if they don't apply to federal employers or federal employers affording those opportunities to federal employees, why can't business do the same?
You know, there are bills on that very issue right now on the Hill, and they're being debated.
I mean, what is thinking? I mean, why isn't it consistent, I wonder?
And just one thing, Donna, the federal employee law
mm-hmm.
is very, when you talked about flexibility getting rigid,
mm-hmm.
well, the federal employee statute really defines quite carefully what a compressed work week can look like. You have to, you know, sign up. There's very formal program around it and remedies available to employees that feel like they haven't been treated fairly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very different context than what you're talking about. So in terms of what would the equivalent would be offering the private sector a very narrow and rigid structure as an exception to the FLSA.
Right now, employers do compress work weeks, but they pretty much, fib about the way they're tracking those hours.
Yeah.
They do patchwork for their payroll system, so they can still do it, and that's a major disincentive, obviously.
Mm. I'm Olivia Tassone from PNC. I was actually on a call earlier today where we were talking about this very issue with the compressed work week and the 40 hours limit. And someone had suggested that if you have your payroll start the work week at noon on Friday,
mm-hmm.
that you're actually not even challenged with that as a result.
Yeah, there are all kinds of things they found out in terms of how they can kind of get around it. So I've heard that one myself.
Right, there is definitely... I don't have the exact study in front of me right now. We had actually written a memo on this where if you start your work week on Friday afternoon till the following Friday morning, then you don't get into the problem of having a compressed work week and working more than 40 hours in a work week.
Yeah.
And Olivia, if you want, I can send you some more specific information about that.
That would be great. Thank you.
I think we have time for like one more question either from the audience, and then I think we'll need to wrap up. We are approaching the hour. I think this has been a terrific audio call. I want to thank our speakers deeply for being on the call and all of our participants for being here. And let's check if there's one more question, and then I will wrap up the call for everyone.
I have a question. This is Mark Sheff from Workforce Management Magazine, question for Sharon Masling or Katie Corrigan. What is the political traction right now for workplace issues on the Hill? Obviously, Congress is sort of overwhelmed by Iraq and immigration and so on. What is the traction in terms of an issue? And politically, is there a potential for workplace flexibility to become partisan like so many other issues have become?
Well, first of all, you've kind of hit the nail on the head of the purpose of our entire project, which is, number one, one of the things we've seen recently on the Hill is very strong interest in these issues. We have one of our outreach tools is that we've been holding some congressional briefings around different aspects of workplace flexibility and how they impact different constituencies. We held one on older workers and flexibility last summer, and earlier this month we held one on workplace flexibility and impact on families. And for both of those briefings, they were bipartisan, and we had great turnout at each one. So, those are just small test cases, but I think there is a real interest because this is a compelling issue that policymakers understand from their own lives and definitely, I think, are hearing about from their constituencies. So, number one, in terms of those test cases, I think there is real interest. And then number two, as we said, we think that in order to develop effective and meaningful policy options, you really need to have, business and employee groups and other relevant constituencies like the family groups and child development groups sitting around a table and talking through how to best achieve workplace flexibility that works for business and families. And I think there you can really have some good bipartisan collaboration.
Mm-hmm. What about labor, Katie?
Mm-hmm. Yep, having absolutely a key player.
Yeah, because I think it's been one of the stumbling blocks. Mm-hmm. I have to hang up, gang. Thank you, Tricia.
Just one real quick follow-up, if I could. Mm-hmm. Do you see in the time frame between 2007 and, I mean, between now, 2006 and 2010, that workplace issues would become electoral issues, that members of Congress would run on these issues and in fact races might be decided or at least heavily influenced by them?
Well, I don't do electoral politics, but when I look at the demographic data and I look at how this cross cuts between generations in terms
right.
of the interest around workplace flexibility, whether you're an older worker, a Gen X or Gen Y worker, whether you're a mom with kids, or a person who has an aging parent, I think all of those demographics are driving in the direction of a need for the structure of work to work for families and for business.
I think it's also interesting. We do what we call a weekly roundup, where we collate all the articles about workplace flexibility that have appeared in the press.
Mm-hmm.
That's both on journals, papers, radio, media.
Right.
And if anyone is interested in getting that, we're happy to send it out to you. But there have been so many stories about this issue. I mean, there's enough information that we have to send out the roundup twice a week that really is chronicling the problem. And I think, the problem is begging for a solution. So whether it's going to be the lead issue when, as you mentioned, Iraq and the economy or other big issues, we don't know. But certainly real people who we talk to on a daily basis and the stories that we read are showing that there's a compelling problem.
Right. And I'm sorry, who's speaking right now?
This is Sharon.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for your great comments. And I'm going to wrap up today's call. This is Tricia. I want to ask you to please watch your list and your email. We will be holding another audio conference in June on the state of play, as it were, related to phased retirement. And again, Workplace 2010 will be participating in that call. We will hold audio conferences in the, throughout the summer and early fall leading up to the 2006 National Employer Summit. And we welcome your recommendations for topics and speakers. So again, thank you so much, Katie and Sharon, and I know Donna had to leave the call, for being here. We deeply appreciate it, and thank you everyone for participating and being a part of the call.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Hello. Hello?
Thank you. Please stand by.